And for this evening's talk, is inspired by a suggestion for a topic from one of the people who's been listening to these talks online for almost 10 years. And the reason I was foraging around in here was to try and remember exactly what this topic was called, because they wanted to talk about autism spectral, and I thought the third word was disorder, but that doesn't make sense. Disease, that doesn't make sense to me, because I think learning differences, I think, was the word which was suggested. Because as soon as you mention disorders, diseases, sometimes that stigmatizes and makes us look at these things in the wrong negative mind state to begin with. But differences is something which we celebrate. Not just that, but you may know that I have no training in psychiatry, clinical psychiatry, or psychology. My training at university was in theoretical physics, which has nothing at all to do with the mind. Something which even negated the very existence of a mind. But through all those years, which I've been practicing as a meditator, and understanding my own mind and how it works, and understanding things which happen to your mind, and being with others, some of those experiences you can give another angle on things like autism, ADHD, dyslexia, Asperger's, all these other words which, quite honestly, I don't know the full meaning of. But that's not the point. Giving different angles, different perspectives, different strategies is a way of adding to ways of even not healing, but embracing, accepting, celebrating, and empowering people who are different. And this is one of the reasons why the person who asked me to talk about this said simple things which they have heard, you know, from the BSWA YouTube site changed their life, and just thank you and please can you share these things with others. So what are the sorts of things, you know, which actually do help? But first of all, that it was reminding me that in a place like the Buddha Society of West Australia, on a Friday night, on a Saturday, at our retreats, and even with people who become monks and nuns. Why do people become monks and nuns? I think there's quite a few of us, and I say us, who become monks or nuns, who come here because somehow the way we are treated in the world doesn't make sense. We don't fit. We want to find another way, another more meaningful way. And sometimes that a monastery, a retreat center, a place where people are accepted and loved and given respect is a strange place for many people. And they come here because they're not told how to be. They're told, if anything, helped to learn how to love who they are and to be at peace with themselves. And so maybe that's one of the reasons why there's many people who sort of ordain as monks. Sometimes I think, well, what did I let them become monks for? Why did I let them become nuns? And I thought, there's something going on here, which is because they're not all sort of who you'd expect to be monks and nuns. But they make great monks and nuns. Why? So, personally, my journey, you know, was sort of at a time when you didn't even know what dyslexia was, or autism, hyperactivity, whatever, dyslexia. But it's learning. And hopefully some of these principles of Buddhism, of Dhamma, of understanding the mind, how it works, can help. It seems it does. So one of the first things is this gentleman was saying that, you know, sometimes that when one has especially ADHD, you know, he remember him describing it. I just have to use the memory because I was just looking for the piece of paper, but as usual, it just gets lost in other pieces of paper which I carry around with me. So, unfortunately. But anyway, what he was saying, that sometimes it's like having, like, his brain, five images going on every second. Just so much information, so much sensory input, so much that it's hard to deal with one piece of information. Hard to focus when so much is going on. And instead of using things like drugs, instead of like using things like institutionalizing, just because you're different and experience this world in a way which doesn't tend to fit in with others, that there is a way of just making peace with it, not fighting it. What he was saying, learning how to love your mind, and not trying to make it different. And of course, one of the key stories, which the gentleman never mentioned, but which I love and think is very pertinent, was the story which I first taught in a conference in Mental Health Week in Western Australia, over in, it was at the convention centre, and it was the day for clients. Not for the psychiatrists, the carers, but for the people who were right there experiencing, you know, what was termed and judged to be mental health issues. And I remember just telling that similes, and one of the similes was that simile of a forest. And I remember afterwards this woman came out. I never forget what she said to me, because when she came out she said, "I want to apologize to you." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because I saw you coming in, I didn't know what a Buddhist monk is, I didn't know what he was doing here. And I thought, what is this, please excuse me, what is this wanker doing coming in here teaching us?" And it's not a polite word. And that's why I mentioned it. And then she said afterwards, "I'm sorry even thinking like that." Because he said that you made me cry, you made me laugh, and you taught me a lot. And one of those first teachings, to love your own mind, was to accept that you belong. And you don't have to change. You don't have to fit in. You don't have to try and change what you feel you are to fit into some, I don't know, what people call as normal, whatever normal means. I think maybe you've seen many, many monks, especially if you go to Thailand and Sri Lanka and Tibetan monks, and I think many of you realize that I'm not normal. How many other monks mention the word wanker in public? And why? Because there's no such thing as normal. But anyway, one thing which I taught, which inspires me, is simile of the forest. One of my most repeated similes. And the reason I repeat it is because it's powerful. And the reason why it's powerful, because it relates to our modern world so well. Go to a forest, a wood, a park, any place. and find a tree which is perfect, the perfect tree. What is a perfect tree? You may see it in a book. You may see it in the botanical gardens. You may see the perfect tree which has been cultivated, protected, fertilized, with no damage, with all the leaves in the right place, with no bugs eating the leaves, with no diseases, with perfect smooth bark. As you all know, such trees just do not exist. You can look all your life in all the forests in the world, you'll never find a perfect tree. No more you can ever find a perfect human being. They just do not exist. And anyway, when I did go walking in the forests, because I lived my life in forests, whether it's in Thailand or over in and some of those forests, they were real rainforests with tigers and elephants. And I just recall one of those beautiful forests which I went to in the very northeast of Thailand in 1978, 79. The last piece of rainforest which was left in that northeast corner of Thailand. And as soon as you went in there, it was always fragrant and cool. The reason was there was always some flower in bloom, and it was always cool. There was elephant poo all over the place, and some tiger poo as well. But you can see just how gorgeous it was. But the trees, the bushes, the shrubs, they were all over the place. Nothing was straight and ordered, like in a like in an orchard or a plantation. It was all higgledy-piggledy, just like Bodhinyana Monastery, all over the place. Just like the monks, all over the place. Just like you. You're not in lines and rows. You're all just sitting where you're comfortable. Imagine if we ordered you. Okay, you here, right behind, like in a military. I don't know why we call it military. But real life is not like in rows and lines. So I used to always look for the most beautiful tree. The most beautiful tree was always bent and twisted. And it was damaged. It's one of the reasons why when people say damaged goods, what the heck is damaged goods? You're all damaged. I'm damaged goods. Am I? But anyway, that because we're damaged, number one, I said to all the clients of the mental health industry, kind, good-hearted people, said you all belong. You're not a misfit. You belong in the forest. Number two, some of you are the most beautiful. And I mention that because that experience which I had volunteering as a student with people with a Down syndrome, thinking I was helping others, thinking that these were poor, unfortunate people, and realizing how wrong I was, learning that these were people I wanted to spend time with. They were sensitive, emotional intelligence, which I had never learned in the Center for Applied Maths and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge University, where people like Stephen Hawking would walk the corridors. But I never learned that there, but I learned it, you know, from people who were shut away. They should never be shut away. They had too much to give to others. And I learned so much from them. I thank them enormously. But not only that, seeing further why it is we judge, especially stigmatized, because they don't fit in, whatever fitting in is. That's why I never like calling these things disorder. I never like calling it even disease. And so I used to love those gentle men and gentle women who had Down syndrome. At least that's what they were taught they had. I used to love people, you know, who were different. Instead of just trying, I used to love my own crazy mind as well. And if you can make peace with the crazy mind, to me what I learnt as a Buddhist monk is that there are times in your meditation practice when they call it hindrances, that you're trying to be peaceful, you're trying to calm the mind, you're trying to get some stillness, and all these thoughts and all these anxieties and fears and stuff might be coming into your mind. Just like that gentleman said, a thousand things coming all at once, you don't know how to deal with these things. And to me, it was, number one, this beautiful sense of kindness. And I used a typical Buddhist story. And it was called the story of Nalagiri the elephant. Nalagiri the elephant. Some of those little stories which I saw in Buddhism, I thought they were just for kids. And realizing they're not just for kids. Nalagiri was supposed to have been made drunk and set on a path where the Buddha was coming with his monks for alms food. Please don't do this at Canning Vale Markets tomorrow for Venerable Santuti. But this was narrow streets. If ever you've been to the old parts of any world, I remember going to Morocco, was a 17-year-old in the Kasbah. Really narrow streets. And the same if you go to India, narrow streets. Even sort of in the old towns of Europe, everything was just so small. And you can imagine setting a wild elephant in the town, in the streets. There's no place to run away, narrow. And it was running towards where the Buddha was. And all these people were running in the opposite direction. Get out of the way, there's a crazy elephant coming, smashing everything. And the Buddha was coming in the opposite direction. Peace, calm, wisdom. Was going to face drunken, mad, powerful rage. It was the contest between compassion and crazy power. What would win? So what happened? As they came closer, I've got to keep this sort of interesting. Build up the tension. So as they came closer, the people saying, get out of the way now. And many of the monks, the holy, attained, peaceful monks, they jumped over the walls, climbed the trees, ran away. So much for peaceful monks. Except for the Buddha and his attendant, Ananda. And what did Ananda do? Ananda stepped in front of his beloved teacher and said, let the elephant kill me and smash me to bits so I can protect the beloved Buddha. And at this point I usually turn to my attendant and say, would you do that? Don't answer. But the Buddha gently pushed Ananda. Okay, very good, made your point. Now it was just the Buddha. Ultimate compassion against ultimate crazy rage, intoxicated with ill will. What would win? And as they came closer and closer together, the Buddha would have done something like Nalagiri, elephant. The door of my heart is fully open to you. Whatever you do to me, you can smash me, you can pick me up in your trunk and hit me against the wall and break every bone in my body. "Well, I forgive you before you even hurt me." And I often say that it's amazing. The Buddha did, I don't know, powers, psychic powers. Okay, you don't usually talk about such things in public, but such things do exist. Seen some of those things. But you know, we just keep them quiet. Because sometimes that Buddha could have very easily grabbed the trunk of the elephant, twirled him 3 times around his head, and thrown him over the Ganges River, which was about 200 miles away. There'd be nothing to the powers of a Buddha. But would a Buddha do that? No. You can kill me instead. And I forgive you already. The door of my heart's open to you, no matter what you ever do to me. And what happened then? That real letting go, that real kindness, making total peace, no fear, the elephant stopped. And according to the story, the elephant stopped, bowed his head, and the Buddha was stroking his trunk. "There, there, not okay. It's okay. There, there." No blame, no punishment, just this wonderful kindness. And I call that a Nalagiri strategy. It's just the way of whenever you feel you're going crazy. You're mad. It's not mad, crazy, those are just words which we use. It's just temporary. When things come at you all at once and you just cannot cope. What do many people do? People do? "Get out of here, you don't belong. I don't want you." Try out of fear, out of rejection, what other people keep telling you, to actually just to control, escape, get rid, blame. Anything which is negative, angry, rejection. "It's okay, mind. I accept you as you are. To love your mind, make peace with it." And recently, some of these little things, which these are classic Buddhist techniques, which, you know, I put out there, and people think, "Ajahn Brahm, you're the crazy one. You're going to get people into a lot of trouble. You've got to do something about these problems." But every now and again, somebody tries this, and they get incredible results. So, the examples of these things was when I saw that people with schizophrenic episodes. What do you do when people say they see human heads rolling right in front of them on the floor? What do you do? And they believe that much more than anything else. And I think some experiments which were done over in Finland, I think, were saying instead of saying to people what they're saying isn't real, to them it was real. Acknowledging that. So we respect your view of the world, even though we cannot sort of understand it. It's so different than ours. And as soon as they were respected, loved, open the door of your heart to others, the intensity of what we might call a delusion, and the fear, and the negativity, and the stuff which they experienced around that, lessened, it diminished. It was as if just learning how to make peace rather than cure the other person. Here we go again, one of those other, I don't plan these talks obviously, but these same old sayings keep coming up. Don't cure, care. Make caring more important than curing. Care for that person, care for that delusion. We call it a delusion, that different way of looking. And then amazing things can sometimes occur. So, these are the sorts of things which can sometimes happen. And because I give these talks so often all over the place, when I gave a talk some years ago at Singapore Institute of Mental Health, it's over like in Woodlands and north of Singapore, and that given my little speech, and sometimes in a way invite a Buddhist monk Sometimes I wonder just why they invite me, why you listen to me. But anyway, people did. And afterwards, this gentleman came up and said, you know, wonderful talk. Sometimes they say those things, sometimes they mean it, sometimes it's just a polite thing to do. But this fellow came and said, oh, I'm a Roman Catholic. I work in this place. I want you to come and bless my ward. And I thought that was really weird. You know, he wanted a Buddhist monk to bless his ward. And I said, well, you know, what actually is your speciality? And he said, it's the schizophrenia unit. And he said, well, how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore? He's the professor, the head honcho. And he said, I don't treat schizophrenia. And as soon as I heard that, you know, it's something which was different. Some of this fellow was obviously seeing something which was interesting, not the same old, same old. So what do you do? And that's what he said, just as you taught in your speech, I treat the other parts of the person, not just that which exhibits symptoms which are known as schizophrenia. And I thought, wow. There are some wonderful people in this world who are seeing things in a different way. And I put my hand up as, you know, what in Sri Lanka, to the worship. Worshipping his wisdom and his strength to do things in a different way. What's the result? Asking a question whose answer I knew. He said, oh, much better than usual. So these are things where we do break new ground by learning how to be kind. And this gentleman, he used to say to me, or this gentleman who wrote the letter, said the types of meditation that sometimes that he was doing, a type of meditation which I taught such a long time ago, I don't do now, because I teach what I really practice. But it was, he said, the counting meditation with the breath. You know, breathing in one, breathing out one, in two, out two, that sort of stuff. You can read it in some of the books which are in the library, even one of my books. I wrote about doing counting with the breath years and years ago. It's in the basic method of meditation, isn't it? I never read my books. I just write them. Anyway, they're doing that just as an exercise in focusing. Bit of work. But don't just do the work. Because I do enough work in other places, like focusing on you when I'm giving a talk. For those of you, you know, who wonder why I keep looking at people, scanning, it's actually because I'm getting information from you. Stop reading your minds, reading your faces to see if I'm connecting. So this is, you know, why I do this. So this is why you learn all these little, not tricks, but ways. And so that, you know, when sort of you even talk to people, you're bringing up information. And one of the great things about when people do things differently, you know, what I call this is never allowing your learning, your knowledge, everything you've been taught, to stand in the way of truth. Dogma, scriptures, what you're supposed to do. Sometimes it's good, it's true, much of that, but sometimes it stands in the way of what you're feeling, what you know is right. But you feel that in the stillness. Never allow your learning to prevent you feeling, experiencing what really needs to be done. So that gives a sense of moving forward, you know, in things like so-called mental. I always resist mental illness. No. Illness is part of life. Illness is the same as health. There's nothing wrong with being ill. I keep on saying that. It's not a stigma because you're different. So it's just differences, different learnings, different, trying to fit everybody into the same box. So instead, there's a sense of love and the counting thing in those early days. But then I started saying, no, how about making peace? And I gave the old simile, the simile of stress. And why do people stress out? They keep holding the glass, trying to make a solution, trying to make it still, instead of putting it down, letting it go. And I was really amazed, this gentleman who had suffered from many, many, at the time undiagnosed, but he found out it was true, of dyslexia, ADHD, severe, sometimes he was saying, that he could learn how to put down his mind. Imagine it was a glass, and actually putting it down, and not holding it, not attaching, not grasping, not fighting it. This is what grasping, attaching is, trying to do something with it, instead of just put it down. And this is one of the reasons I was really inspired by what he was saying. He said, you know what happens? It becomes still all by itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Because that's something which I do. I have to sort of focus, I have to work, I have to write emails and learn how to write emails when I was just used to just writing it out by hand. And you know that that first book, Open the Door of Your Heart, that book I wrote under duress because somebody wanted me to. And they said, I have to. They do psychological warfare on me. So you should be ashamed of yourself if you don't write that down. It can help so many people. So they are too busy. They said, we'll write it then. So they write about 4 or 5 stories, handed it to me, and it was absolute rubbish. They're brilliant. They really caught me out. So I said, well, I'm going to have to do it myself, aren't I? And that's exactly what they wanted me to. So anyway, and I remember just the first 54 stories of those, the first half, were written 1 hour, just over 2 weeks. 14 days. I finished 54 stories. Just longhand, writing it out, and hardly any mistakes. Perfect handwriting. I couldn't believe it when I saw it afterwards, because someone has the manuscript, the original manuscript, and it's just almost perfect. How the heck can that happen? And you're focused. So you learn how to use this wonderful sense of focusing, and you get so much stuff done so quickly. And think, no mistake, I was writing by hand. I just had some white, with that white out, in case you made any mistakes. There's hardly any mistakes on there, maybe one a page or that's all. Perfect, beautiful handwriting. How can I do that? It was just learning how to just that focusing. Which, something which is a skill which I had learned through meditation. It's what happens when you do things like counting with the breath. You're really there. You don't let the mind move anywhere. That focusing is important, but you can get tired out too easily. And sometimes, if you don't balance that with letting go, you get stressed. And especially for anyone with any sort of stress-related problems, of course that's going to really sort of screw you up even more. So instead, your time when you just put things down, put down the cup, let it go. And when I saw this person could do that, easy. And I thought, wow, if this person, when he told me about his life, well, that's amazing that you can do that. And I thought, I'd sort of obviously do that a lot, putting down the cup and letting go and being peaceful. So I thought maybe just training you have to do that. No, each one of you can do that. So he raised the opportunity, opened up more possibilities of letting go. And so sometimes he said when he's got 1,000 thoughts coming really, really fast into his brain, really sort of getting overload, puts it down. Now that is something which I thought, I thought maybe you do that to get into deep meditations and jhanas and stuff. But to do that to cope with, just episodes, deep episodes of, of hyperactivity, which was not so much physical. I imagine that most people have, hyperactivity in the brain, thinking 1,000 miles an hour. And just how do you stop that? You try and stop that. You try and put effort into it. You try and restrain it. You get negative towards it. What happens? It gets worse. My example. Sometimes I get into trouble with my examples. I tell this on retreats. Don't usually tell it so much sort of in public here. I don't know if I've told it here. I think it's in Open the Door of Your Heart. I once found this beautiful monastery in the north of Thailand. It was up in the mountains above Merdeng district. It was in the middle of a tea plantation. For an English monk, this was paradise. It's cool, as much tea as I ever wanted to drink. And there was an abandoned monastery. No one, no monk was there. And I couldn't believe this. And I asked the villagers, so this is perfect. It had a beautiful cave, just nice food. The people there, all they wanted to do was feed me. Not ask any questions, not, learn meditation and just have talks every week. They wanted just to feed me and leave me alone for 3 months. Wow, great. And I said, why aren't there any other monks here? You know what they said? Because it's too quiet for them. I remember saying, I thought, wow, I wonder why. So I was very quiet all by myself most of the day, and hardly any work, meditating and meditating and meditating. It was only about a month when my mind started to go crazy. The thoughts started coming in thick and fast, and I didn't have anybody to speak to. There was no teacher to go to. It was up in the mountains. There was no way of sending a letter or no mobile phones or any old phones or anything. So there you were in your hut, all these thoughts. And I have to confess to you, these were not the sort of thoughts which a monk should entertain. Thoughts of old girlfriends. I wonder if she's still available. No, stop it, that's a problem. You're not supposed to think like that. Because I was only, at the time, I was about 28, that's all. Still young and fit and handsome and good degree. I still had lots of earning potential. Now, stop it. I like being a monk. I really love being a monk. And a thought would come in, another ex-girl, a fantasy or something, a romance, and get into it. Stop it. And the more I tried to stop it, the worse it got. I never realized at the time. You're trying to watch your breath, see, and then watch your breath go in, go out, breath go in, and then I thought, oh yeah, I mean, she was really nice. No, stop it. And it got worse and worse and worse. And if ever you've had those sorts of attacks, you just could not stop them. You go mad. And so I just went into the only thing I could do. I bowed 3 times to the big Buddha statue there and just help. And just an idea came up. And the idea was, do a deal. This was years and years and years before Trump. They're just Western to do a deal. And the deal was this, a compromise. Was, for most of the day, I behave. No, that's right. But for 1 hour every day, 1 hour every afternoon, 3 p.m. to 4 p.m, I let my mind think whatever it wanted to. Nothing was prohibited. Any weird sexual fantasy, romantic thought, you could come in. For the rest of the time, you behave. That's what I thought. So what happened was, I was meditating, same old, same old. Tried to watch the breath, these weird thoughts came in, unwanted. 3 o'clock, went up to my hut, sat down, exhausted. then against the wall. Okay, any thought you want. This was sexy time. Okay, being honest, don't criticise me for mentioning that word, but I'm being honest. And what happened next just blew me away. For the next hour, my mind watched every breath without missing one. So easy, so peaceful. So what on earth's going on? Am I trying to focus my mind on my breath? I got all these weird, strange thoughts getting worse and worse and worse. But I just, okay, mind whatever you want. I was at peace and love my mind without what we call my unconditional mindfulness without judging, mindfulness without discriminating, just being, not judging, not saying you can come in and you can't, not stigmatizing, not pushing certain thoughts out and other thoughts in, not just saying to come into the Buddhist society in West Australia you've got to be a Buddhist, you've got to be well dressed, you've got to be this, you've got to be that, you've got to be something else. It's beautiful acceptance and love and peace. Not trying to, I never realised these words, not curing my mind, but caring for it. It's okay, Nalagiri. It's okay, crazy mind. You can drive me crazy, you can hit me against the wall, but I'm just going to be kind to you. I forgive you, my crazy sexual mind. And it became peaceful. It became still. There's no problem anymore. This is where I had learned something about my own craziness. And just what fed it? Discrimination, pushing out. You don't fit in. Get out of here. We can cure you. So I don't know who you are. Has anyone ever said, oh, we can cure you? We can make you different. We can actually change you. We can make you fit what a real girl is supposed to be like. What a real man is supposed to be like. What a real, I don't know, what a real monk is supposed to be like. What a real nun is supposed to be, I don't know. But you see that that is something which has got nothing to do with how I understand Dhamma to be, Buddhism to be. It's a misunderstanding. The reality right now is learning how to make peace and be kind. Learning how to put the glass down. Let it go. Let it be. It's amazing just sometimes that when you do things like that, it's another skill which you can have. And times when you are sick, when you are ill, whatever that is, that's part of life. When you're dying, just let it be. What's the problem? Because you're not supposed to die, are you? We're just talking on the way up here. Because people are just, oh, they're always kind and they're offering a car to us. I say, no, we don't want a sort of a four-wheel drive. The sort of car I would really like. And I think when Ajahn Jacaro was around, I said, let's get one of these. It was a hearse. Why are you laughing about that? That's such a practical vehicle. You know, hearse. Number one, I was told this, you know, with my funeral directors, you don't have to wear a seatbelt. By law, you have to wear a seatbelt, but no policeman would stop you for not wearing a seatbelt in the front of a hearse. Never been done. And if you get tired, as a monk, apparently in camper vans, you know, when the camper van is actually, or you're towing a caravan, you're not allowed to go in the back to sleep. So I've been told, I'm not sure, but if you're in the back of a hearse and you're laying down, no one will check that you're still alive. So, you know, just on a long journey, you know, you're going up to Geraldton or you're going down to Albany or somewhere, you can go in the back there in the box and have a nice rest. And it's pretty comfy in there, and no one stop you. So I started all these examples of just, you know, and you can park it anywhere because no one would actually would put a sticker on it. So, anyway. Is that thing? Is thinking outside, not thinking outside the box, but thinking with a box. And so sometimes people, actually, Bob, you are weird. You know, you really are mentally ill or something. But I think you can see just the whole attitude which we have here is changing what it's like. And even recently when somebody was depressed because their partner died, someone they really loved so well and so close to, they're really depressed. And I just told him, I said, you know, enjoy your depression. When you go over it, don't tell your carers you're over the depression. Just stay there, because he said, oh yeah, because that morning he had double ice cream. They allow you to do that if you're sick. You know, because especially if you're depressed, you know, because you just lost your partner, just have another ice cream. And he liked his ice cream. As soon as he got better, then he wouldn't have that privilege anymore. He'd have to look after his weight and health and stuff. So as soon as I started saying stuff like that, he really got it. So sometimes when we look at even sickness, mental illness, being different. I'm coming up to the joke of this evening now. And it's only at the end that you can maybe understand this joke and maybe just realize this is not offensive at all. When people asked in Buddhist monastery, do the monks suffer from mental illnesses? I said, no, we don't suffer from mental illnesses, we enjoy them. Okay, any questions? Okay, I don't know if I did justice to the subject, but I tried my best. Yes.
Thank you so much. It's just so wonderful to come here and to have your humour and your profound experiences and sharing. And it just happens that I've got a book here on autism. I was reading it in the library. It's my book, though. It's called The Spark, A Mother's Journey, A Story of Nurturing Genius. Yeah. And it's about a mother who didn't want her child being lost in the system, and she actually did exactly what you said, that, yeah, you know, just loved him and brought out his the things that he loved. And then she set up a whole school for children with parents with the same, with autism, that didn't fit into the schools, kindergarten, with, you know, just bringing out the things that they loved. And it transformed those children. It actually helped them to go to school, and it helped them to fit in, because they were doing what they loved and they were playing and they were having fun. And I really relate to this, because I grew up with ADD, always daring to be different. That's how I see it. I couldn't speak English when I went to school, so that was another, you know, very difficult thing. But I grew up loving life, loving people, and I actually used to be a therapist for ADD, and I loved the children and loved the parents. So thank you very much for tonight. It was very profound. Thank you.
Excellent. Okay, there's something from overseas. I'm not an expert on these things, but I just understand my mind. Here we go. From Canada, from USA, Phoenix, and from Indonesia. How do we as parents work with teachers and doctors who see only disorders and problems in our kids who do not fit into the mold and need to be fixed? It's great if you've got a broken leg and fix that, yes. But broken mind? So I think life is changing, word is getting around, there are different ways of doing things. Teachers and doctors, disorders, change the language. Differences, yeah, but we celebrate differences. We work together with differences. And I must admit, over in Germany, I think in Hamburg, when I went there years ago, not that many years ago, that one of the Buddhists there, that they were the head of, in that particular part of Germany, of integrating everybody in schools. So you don't have a separate school for so-called normal people, whatever that means, and people with schizophrenia, with ADHD, with autism. Everybody was in the school together. And it meant that we loved. They weren't separated. And special needs, the other kids in the school, in that class, would provide those special needs. They were family. They were friends. They grew up together. And it reminds me of this girl over in the village in Thailand, where they didn't have words for these things, but I don't know what her learning difficulty is, because she couldn't speak, but she would grunt. That's all I could say. She would grunt, and every other kid of her age knew what every grunt meant. I couldn't understand it. No one else, the parents couldn't, but their friends did. And she would go out to the parties, come to the monasteries, and she had a really full life. She was accepted for who she was, totally, totally loved. And that just opened my eyes a lot. So when we separate people, even give the language of, you know, special needs, that means sometimes you're different. Why not just different needs? Difference is fine, but special means unspecial and stigmatizing. Oh, you know, they're special. But difference, maybe. Let's change the language. I think the language has a lot to do with the problem which we face. And the fear as well. Doctors and teachers, they've got to be assessed. Performance. Fortunately, I don't need performance assessment. Because, you know, I don't mind if I get sacked. Because I can have a nice peaceful time in monastery. But I think some of those problems maybe, I don't know. Anyway, from USA, people with high functioning autism, which few strangers can detect, response to them is often impatience. How can we help those with high functioning autism deal with rejection? And again, it's just to try and have a more open society. Now, where, again, please, whoever has high functioning autism, don't hide it, don't suppress it, celebrate it. You're a tree in the forest, you belong, and you become very beautiful, and you don't need to feel rejected. That's one of the things of rejection. You don't belong, you know, you're different, so don't be in the forest. In the middle of the forest. Central, and some of the most beautiful, wonderful people. So deal with the rejection. You just refuse to be rejected. Just go out there. Show your stuff. Know that you don't deserve rejection. That you are not less than anybody else. How do we manage to stay calm when we deal with autism people at work? This person took for granted of our kindness, always wanted us to treat them special. Not special. Different, yes, but not special. Fit in, whatever a person needs. If someone is old, obviously they need not stairs maybe, but just the elevator. You know, we have, fortunately now, sort of we have in our even legislation here, we have to have wide enough doors so anyone in a wheelchair can come in. Places where anybody who is different can actually have a place to sit. You know, in some monasteries you have to sit on the floor. What are you talking about? Have chairs. What's wrong with chairs? You're not disabled, you just got, you know, bad legs. Why should that stop people from listening to meditating and stuff? So anyway, those are the things which sometimes that deal with people who are different at work. Just adapt. Make it. Treat him and their special, treat them as different. If you were sort of sick, if you had a broken leg, wouldn't you want to sort of have a place where you can sit down comfortably? You can access everything. So, manage to stay calm when we deal with autism. The problem is at work, again, people are so stressed out, doing far too much, which means We don't have the resilience to deal with people who are different. An old simile of string being too tight. Loosen the string, for goodness sake, in your workplace. Be more tolerant of yourself and of others. Anyway, there we go for this evening. Hopefully it was of use to you. Again, just thank you for the gentleman who just asked me to actually to say something, not very much, but just that acceptance, tolerance, and learning how to be. And just how some of these teachings were said, put things down, focusing, accept, don't fight, make peace, basic compassion, love, open the door of your heart, and don't think that differences mean everyone has to be the same. Human beings are not a plantation in the forest with everything in lines and rows, and there's all over the place. That's life, and all over the place is welcome. Okay, Eddie, what would be a Friday night talk without Eddie? Come on. I'll have to mention Eddie during the week. Please, I'm going to drop you in for this. That we got a call on Monday morning. And the call was, monks of Bodhidharma Monastery, there's an elephant in the front gate and it stops people coming in and parking. April the 1st morning. The only April Fool joke we got. Thank you, Eddie.
But Acharya Brahm, I was disappointed, you know. You know why?
Why?
Because I was told no one got fooled. But I think they bluffed me.
Yeah. It's because we recognise your voice, Eddie. But thank you for that. It was good.
Acharya Brahm, regarding this ADHD, you know, autism, you know, we Buddhists, we believe in cause and effect. Yeah. So in this case, they are born with such things, you know. So the cause would be from, could be previous life conditioning. Alright, yeah. I was thinking in terms of the 12 links, you know, the law of dependent origination, because that covers, the first two covers previous lives too. You know. So if really, you know, like this therapist or scientist can really look into this, you know, like this, you know, like from previous life conditions this, and this life too, this conditions that, this ceases, that ceases, you know. They could find an answer to it. What do you think?
Yeah, well, it's if a person could really know for certain what happened in a previous life, fine. But there's very few people can ever do that. We can never be so certain. And by the time we find out the cause of things, like the simile of the person shot with the arrow. Why? Who shot the arrow? Why did they shoot the arrow? What race, what caste, what nationality were they? What type of arrow it was? You'd die before you found out the causes. So, call a doctor, take the arrow out first. That's the old simile of the arrow. So, yeah, causes in a big term, but, you know, who could even know? Genetic, environmental, there's many theories. But while people are finding out those theories, there's people who are being discriminated and marginalized. So, that's something we can do now. Take out that arrow in our societies. And then people are different. Ooh, great. Thank you for the difference.
See, we Buddhists, we look into the mind, you know. Maybe if it's conditioned, the cause is from the mind, there could be something, you know, if it's like either environmental or whatever, is another thing. If it's mind, they could find...
Oh, it could do, yeah, but that would be just too difficult. In the meantime, many people would be suffering. Okay, excellent. So thank you all for listening. Now you can pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha if you wish to. You don't have to. And afterwards, we can, whatever we need to do. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And for those who don't know, what does sadhu mean? Awesome. Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhīmi
Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.
Very good.